Ladies and gentlemen, welcome back to Torah Studies. This is our weekly journey into the soul of the Torah portion. So this week's Torah portion is a very special one, Mishpatim. Why is it special? It's my bar mitzvah Torah portion. Yes, that's why it's special. And tonight is my birthday, so thank you for this. So my blessings on a birthday. We all have special mazel that we can share with others. So I'd like to give a bracha, blessing. Good health, spiritual riches, physical riches, everything that we need and everything that we want, we should have in a very good way. Okay, so let's jump in, my pleasure. Let's jump into the Torah portion. Let's open up the Chumash. Mishpatim begins on page 478 and 479. It's interesting because if you look through Mishpatim, which we'll do a little bit, when you look through Mishpatim, you'll quickly realize that there are so many details of Jewish law. It's so tedious, so many details. And not tedious in a bad way, but tedious in a tedious way. There's a lot of... Does tedious have a negative connotation?
Yes,
it does. It does, right?
Absolutely.
All right, let me strike that from the record. It's very detailed. Very detail-oriented is Mishpatim. So we have civil law. We have torts and damages law. There's so many different laws. I mean, let's just flip through these. 479 is the laws of servants and slaves. Okay, that kind of seems outdated, right? But in its context, it makes a lot of sense. 483, laws of assault and kidnapping. That doesn't sound great, but you know what happens when that happens? 485, laws of negligence and theft. There you go, negligence and theft. 491, a discussion of the four guardians. What happens if you ask someone to watch your dog while you go out of town and the dog dies? God forbid. Not your dog, someone's dog, right? So someone gives someone else. Reuven gives Shimon his dog while Reuven goes out of town. When he comes back, Shimon says, "Oh, I've got good news and bad news." What's the good news? The good news is, I don't know. The bad news is your dog died, right? So what happens? Reuven says, "How could you? The dog was in great health. What did you do? I didn't do anything. I fed the dog. You fed the dog? I fed the dog." All right. Is he liable? Is he not liable? What happens if you rent a car? You rent a car from your friend. No contracts.
Huh?
Yeah. But back in the day, they used to rent oxen. It's a thing. No contract. Huh?
You rent. You pay.
So here's the thing. Imagine I'm going out on a date. Right? I'm a young guy going out on a date. I don't have a car. It's New York City. Who has a car in New York City? Young guy in New York City. I need a date to drive my date. We're not taking the subway. That's not, it's past niche. It's not Uber. I don't know. You could. I was going to say, I wonder if now in Chabad, sir, I'm just thinking about the circles that I grew up in, if they're Ubering dates. I don't think so. I think you know what they do now in New York? Oh, it's the latest. They have like these, off the grid car rental folk where you text the guy. You just text the guy. "You have a car available. Well, when do you need it?" You text time and day and everything. And he's like, "Sure, no problem. Go to so-and-so street." And there's he does a mobile unlock. And the keys are in the car. And it's like everything is done remotely. Can lock and unlock, monitor where you are. And the whole deal, you pay remotely. Like the whole thing is done. You don't have to walk any. You don't have to, it's cool. Anyway, so what's my point? So let's say I need a car, and you have a car. Reb David, you have a car. So I pay you $50 to use your car for a day. And then, not me, because we're not, right? But then the renter of the car gets into a fender bender. And you say, "Hey, I gave you a nice car. You gave me back a fender bender car. What's up with that?" And I say, "Okay, but I paid you $50. You're like, "Well, $50 is not going to cover it. There's no contract. What's the liability?" So again, these are all cases of four guardians. There's four categories: the unpaid guardian, the paid guardian, the renter, and the borrower. So all of these are discussed right here in Torah. 493, illicit and idolatrous behavior. 493, helping the unfortunate, respecting leaders. 495, agricultural offerings, judicial laws and avoiding prejudice, Shabbos and Yom Tov, and 497, The hits go on. However, on 499, that's where we get to the discussion of tonight. That's where we get to the point, to the verse that we are going to explore at depth. For tonight, as I wrote in the email, is all about the Kabbalah of a cheeseburger, but I decided after I sent out that email that I really have a better title. It's the Kabbalah of the Philly cheesesteak. That's what it is. Cheeseburger is so last week. It's the Philly or the chili cheese steak. No, the Philly cheesesteak. And that's what we're talking about. The Kabbalah of milk and meat. The relevant verse is right here on 499. Lisa, please read verse 19, second to last paragraph, and then the second to last bullet point, and then the last bullet point as well.
Wait, on 499?
499, which says, bring to the house.
Right, bring to the house of God, your God, the choicest of the first fruits of your soil, even in the seventh year. Do not cook a tender young animal in its mother's milk.
There we have it. So the Torah says two seemingly unrelated commandments in the same verse. The first one is, the first fruits you shall bring to God. That's a mitzvah, bikurim. Reshit bikurei admatcha, bring the first of your, the choices of your first fruits. Okay, that's one mitzvah. And the second one is, lo tevashal gedi b'chalev imo, do not cook a gedi. What's a gedi?
A young goat.
Which we call, what do we call it?
A kid.
Don't cook a kid, not that type of kid, but don't cook that type of, the other type of kid, a kid goat, or a gedi, in its mother's milk.
So as long as the mother's milk is not there, you could put the kid on the fire and just burn them alive after they annoy you.
That's the other kid. That's not the kid that we're kidding. Yeah. No kidding. Okay. So this is the prohibition in Torah against, well, this is what we're going to get into, against things pertaining to meat and milk. But again, in the verse itself, it talks about cooking a kid in its mother's milk. So let's jump into some texts. Because if you just read this, you would say, okay, so I can take a kid goat and cook it in its mother's milk. But otherwise, we're good. We're safe. Right? Otherwise, it's all good. By the way, huh?
What chicken?
Chicken for sure. It's not even, I mean, chicken is for sure not even mentioned. But even a kid, yeah. If I don't cook it in its mother's milk, if I, you know, smear on some dairy substances, but I didn't cook it in its mother's milk, or if I cooked it in milk, but it wasn't its mother's milk, you would say, maybe it's kosher, maybe it's fine. The Torah doesn't say it otherwise. It just says, don't cook a gedi in its mother's milk. Well, it's not its mother's milk. Or what if it's not a kid? What if it's beef? It's not a goat. It's not a young goat. It's beef.
Beef Wellington.
Beef what? What is beef Wellington?
I don't know. It has some milk. Extent.
Oh, does it have milk?
Potatoes in it.
Well, potatoes are fine. It's got cream.
Cream of milk.
Cream of Gadi's mother. Okay, so here is the... Oh, by the way, I saw a funny video from a kosher restaurant. $1,000 pastrami sandwich. $1,000 pastrami sandwich. And then I saw a picture, so I saw the chef making it. And I don't know if it's real, if it's not real. Somebody just sent it. No, it's just one sandwich. Everything goes craft, handmade. It doesn't matter how much handmade you got. It's not $1,000. I mean, it's a sandwich. I mean, seriously. And then you see the chevroman, the guy, eating it, and the receipt. He used a 10% off coupon. That's so Jewish. Such a Jew. So Jewish. I love Jews. That was so Jewish. You see the receipt. I could pull it up. I'm gonna pull it up. But not everyone can see it. All right, whatever. I'll put it up after the class, and we'll all gather around and have a chuckle. The guy, it's $1,000 plus tax. Then you take off the 10%, but then he tips.
In New York? Seriously?
It's in New York, 5 times. Then he tips 20% though. 20% off a sandwich. He's tipping like $200 on a sandwich. Anyway, it's a thing. It's a thing. For some people, it's a thing.
But if you go to New York, I don't know if Chabad Hefzer will recognize their Hefzer, but you got to...
Depends how good the food is.
Like a pastrami sandwich or a corned beef sandwich at Second Avenue Deli.
So this I don't know. I've never heard of it.
You have to. It's not on Second Avenue anymore.
That's
on
like
32nd and Lenox, but.
All right.
It's called Second Avenue.
Second Avenue Deli. Interesting. We'll have to check it out. Anywho, back to the programming. Here's the point. The Torah just says, do not cook the kid in its mother's milk. You know, if reading Torah the way it's written, we would think it's pretty simple. So tonight we're going to explore how this verse becomes expanded to include the various prohibitions about mixing meat and milk altogether, number one. Number two, and perhaps most important, well, and then we'll also learn some associated laws about eating both milk and meat and how we have to, you know, wait in between one and the other. And then we're going to get into how these laws are learned in heaven. You know, Torah exists in Shemayim. The angels study Torah. What they're talking about, meat and milk. Literally, they're talking about, what do they have to do? What do they know about meat and milk? So, you know, as souls study Torah, as the angels study Torah, it's a different Torah. It says that Torah preceded the world by 2,000 years. So what is, was it talking about all of these physical elements of Torah? Not necessarily. So tonight we're going to study some laws of meat and milk as they exist on a spiritual plane and hopefully derive some insights that we can apply to our personal lives. So let us begin with the legal discussion about what is the prohibition including here. So let's open up the Torah studies text, text number 3. Please. Text number 3. All right, Sandrine, please read this. Page 101. This comes from the Sefer HaChinuch, who explains various mitzvot of the Torah. And the Chinuch here is concerned with explaining how you go from Gedi, which means a kid, to the prohibition, to the general prohibition against mixing meat and milk. In other words, how do you go from a specific type of animal to a broad category of meat? Text 3.
There is a mitzvah not to cook animal meat in milk, as it is stated. You should not cook a kid in his mother's milk. The Talmud explained that this refers not only to a kid specifically, but rather all animal meat. The term gedi, kid, is known from the text of the Torah to be a general term for meat, since all meat is soft like kid meat. How do we know that gedi is a general term for meat and not specifically to goats? In several places throughout the Torah, the word gedi is used with the qualification a goat kid, gedi izim. This implies that where the Torah does not qualify kid with the word goat, it refers to animal meat in general.
So this is a fascinating point that he says, quoting the Talmud. He says like this, when the Torah means only a kid, goat, it says gedi izim. It actually uses the kid of a goat. But when it just says gedi, like it does here with meat and milk, it says lo tavashal gedi b'chalev imo. It doesn't say lo tavashal gedi izim. It says lo tavashal, don't cook a gedi. So the Chinuch says, quoting the Talmud, that this opens it up to not just this one type of meat, but rather all types of meat. Now you should know that other meats, not animal meat or cattle meat, but for example, birds, fowl, chicken, etc. So those are typically understood to be of rabbinic origin. In other words, a prohibition about mixing them with milk is of rabbinic origin. The Torah's message here, the Torah's prohibition, if you will, is about the gedi, which is not only gedi; it's animal meat in its mother's milk. Now, the question is, we're still stuck with this. Now, even if we've expanded on the meat side, it seems like the only problem with the meat is to cook it in its mother's milk. How do we know about the other? What's the problem then with once it's cooked, or what's the problem with cooking it in other milk, or what's the problem with once it's cooked to put a dairy, you know, a piece of cheese on top of it? It's not cooking in its mother's milk. What's the problem? So text number 4, the Talmud and other sources of Jewish law explain that the repetition of the verses, which I'll explain in a second, the very fact that this prohibition against cooking the kid in its mother's milk is repeated multiple times, the very fact that this is repeated indicates that there are additional laws that the Torah is including. Chazen Ben, please read text number 4, page 102.
Yeah, I was looking ahead at text number 6, and I was thinking that actually the Talmud invented luggage. Because of Shimon the Amsonite, if you take the S.
Shimon the Amsonite. It was, well, Samsonite. The truth is it was originally Shamsonite. Shamsonite. And then they just dropped the H, you know. They wanted to make it.
Anyway, okay, text number 4. You shall bring the choicest first fruits of your land into the house of God. You shall not cook a kid in his mother's milk.
Now this is a verse, it's the same verse that we had in our Torah portion, but this is a few Torah portions ahead. This is in Parashat Ki Tetze. This is our verses, chapter 23 of Exodus. This is 34. It's the same verse. You know what? That was a small one. We'll give you one more. Text number 5. This is the third instance.
You shall not eat anything that has died without being slaughtered. You may instead give it to the stranger within your gates for him to eat, or you may sell it to a foreigner because you are a holy people to God, your God. You shall not cook a kid in its mother's milk.
And that is from the Torah portion of Re'eh in the book of Deuteronomy, chapter 14. This is the third time that the very same words are used in Torah, lo tevashel gedi b'chalev imo. The question is, obviously, the question is, why is the Torah repeating the same exact law three times? We know that Torah is not, Torah doesn't use excessive language or floral language or poetic language for no legal purpose. And many laws are learned out from very small nuances of the text. So why repeat a whole law three times? It's from this that our sages derive. There are three different prohibitions that are being alluded to here. But before we do that, what did I want to point out? I don't know that I wanted to point out anything now. Okay, so let's move on. Let's actually go to text number 6 and the Amsonite, Shimon the Amsonite text.
Shimon David. The Amsonite, and some say it was Nechamia the Amsonite, would interpret every mention of the word et in the Torah, using it to include additional meanings until he reached the verse, "You shall fear et God your God." He then ceased his interpretation. His students asked him, "Rabbi, what will become of every et you interpreted until now?" He responded, "Just as I was rewarded for interpreting them, I will be rewarded for ceasing my interpretation." Thereafter, no one learned from the word et until Rabbi Akiva came and interpreted the verse that had puzzled his predecessors. "You shall fear et the Lord your God," and et comes to the fear of students.
So this is fascinating. So the Talmud explains, you know, in Hebrew, the word et is a little bit, it's hard to translate. For example, the opening verse in Torah says, Bereshit, in the beginning, Bara Elokim, God created, et hashamayim ve'et haaretz, which is translated as the heavens and the earth. But why couldn't it have said, Bereshit, Bara Elokim, in the beginning, God created, hashamayim ve'aretz, heaven and earth? What's this et business? So Shimon the Amsonite, and some say it was Nechemiah the Amsonite, one of the Amsonites, one of the Amsonite lines. So they said, they learned, they interpreted every et to be inclusive of something else that's not stated clearly. So when it says heaven and earth, that's clear, that's explicit. But what is the word? There's two extra ets, so, or etim, whatever, however you pronounce it, et hashamayim ve'et haaretz, each one is including, because there's an extra word, it's including something else. So not only did God create the heavens and the earth, but he also created whatever it is that the interpretation would have it. Or another example, when it says kabed et avicha ve'et imecha, honor, in the Ten Commandments, honor et your father and et your mother, kabed et avicha ve'et imecha, instead of just avicha ve'imecha, so our sages say, what is the extra et's including? They include honoring your older sibling or honoring your grandparents, right? So it's those extra ets that tell us it's not only your mother and your father, but it's also a sibling that's older. Because honoring an older sibling is also honoring your parents. Or honoring your parents' parents, that's also honoring your parents. The point is that the extra word et, it's not just a connecting word or a grammatical flourish. No, it's teaching us something instructive, and they came up with something that et is adding on subtly for every single instance of the word et until they came to the verse that talks about fearing God. And it says, you shall fear et Hashem Elokecha, you shall fear et God, your God. And now the question is, what else are you fearing? Are you fearing anything else other than God? That seems blasphemous. In other words, when it talks about fearing God, you would think it's an exclusive. So if it's exclusive, then what's the et? Ah, must mean that et does not include anything else. So if so, they tore up all of their thesis of all the other ets. They tore it up until Rabbi Akiva came and he said, no, this et about fearing God also includes others, and it includes Talmidei Chachamim, which is translated here as students of Torah, but Talmidei Chachamim, more colloquially, is translated as Torah scholars. So it means not only to fear God, but also Torah scholars. Why? Because Torah scholars are they are the torchbearers, so to speak, of Torah, and Torah is God's Torah. And of course, we're not talking about an arrogant Torah scholar, but a humble Torah scholar that represents Torah. So one should have reverence as well for the Torah scholar, not necessarily for them, but for the Torah that they study, and respect for the Torah that they study. And that's what's included by the extra word et. And so Rabbi Akiva resurrected, if you will, all of the other et interpretations. All this makes sense? That's the Talmud. What's the point for us?
Yeah. What? In the middle of all of this, we're talking about Lo Tevashel Gedi B'chal Erinu, and all of a sudden there's et.
Ah, so what's the point? The point is, every extra word, every extra et is significant. Text 7, which we're going to skip over, because we've had this before in other classes, every crown of every letter is important. And Rabbi Akiva would interpret the crowns, the lines, the crowns on top of the letters, the flourishes. Everything has meaning. So if you have a verse, a prohibition, repeated 3 times, you can't just chalk it up to, maybe God forgot that it was already stated. It's like, did I tell you about the goat and the mother's... I forgot. Did I tell you about the goat and the mother's... It's not what's happening, right? God is specific. Torah is precise. If it's mentioned 3 times, says the Talmud, it's telling us that there are 3 distinct prohibitions when it comes to the mixture of milk and meat. Let's read it inside. Rabbi David, please read it inside. No, in the Torah studies text, text number 8 on page 105.
Where are the 2 other places?
So we had them before. So they're in also Exodus. Yeah, I'll show you the texts. It's text 4 and text 5. And the first one, if you want to just see it in the Torah studies text, so it's text 2, text 4, and text 5. Those are the 3 times that it says it. Exodus 23, Exodus 34, and Deuteronomy 14. Now, take a look at what the Talmud says, text number 8, to bring everything together.
The school of Rabbi Ishmael taught, you shall not cook a kid in its mother's milk. It's mentioned 3 times. One is the prohibition of eating. One is the prohibition of benefiting, and one is the prohibition of cooking.
Here we go. Tana Devei Rabbi Yishmael. Devei Rabbi Yishmael Tana. So the school of Rabbi Yishmael is teaching this idea of Jewish law, and that is that what is the significance of the 3 times that the same prohibition of not cooking the Gedi, which we already said, we've already established, is not exclusive to a kid goat's meat, but any type of animal meat in its mother's milk. It's not only cooking that's prohibited, it's also benefiting. And not only benefiting from, but it's also eating. And now we have the full picture. The 3 instances of the same prohibition being mentioned open it up to 3 different actions. Now, why doesn't it just say 3 times each specific prohibition? Don't eat them together. Don't benefit from them together, which means like to sell it or to feed it to your animal. And don't cook it. Why does it just say cooking 3 times? So there's a whole huge interpretation on that and an explanation, and it's a wonderful thing. We don't have time for it. But the point is, the Talmud says, from this triplicate this threefold mention of the same prohibition, it tells us that there are really three different prohibitions. One is utilizing the order of the Talmud. One is eating them together, even if they weren't cooked together. So you cook the meat on the grill, the cheese is, you know, doing its thing separate. But now you put them together to eat them together. So that's also included in the prohibition, number one. Number two, benefiting. I'm not eating it, and I didn't cook it together. I'm just putting the two together and making a profit by selling it to somebody else. Benefiting. Can't benefit. By the way, this is a real question when it comes to people that own restaurants that aren't kosher. Can you own a restaurant that is not kosher? So when it comes to non-kosher food, there's no prohibition against Hana, against benefiting from. This prohibition of benefiting is exclusive to milk and meat together. So if you own a regular non-kosher restaurant, a steakhouse or whatever it is, I mean, assuming there's no, then it could be fine. But again, if you have the mixture of milk and meat, then it becomes a little bit trickier. Now, what do people do? So there are some Jewish legal loopholes. I would say loopholes. You can have, you know, if you're a partner in the business, then, you know, it's good to have a partner and then say that my profit only comes from these types of items that are sold and not those types of items, right? Or I only get revenue from, you know, this part of the menu, not that. Whatever. There's ways to do it where you can structure a contract so that, you know, legally you're protected from this prohibition. But
Robert, are you saying that this only applies to kosher restaurants?
No. What I'm saying is that if you're
an observant Jew, you can own a non-kosher restaurant, right? That's what you're saying.
That's what I'm trying to say. Yeah. Right. You can own a non-kosher restaurant and make a profit and make a lot of money on non-kosher food. But there is a prohibition, a biblical prohibition, as the Talmud explains, from benefiting specifically from meat and milk that are mixed together. What I'm saying is, if you, there was a fellow in Pittsburgh who became Balei Tshuva. They became observant, and the family owned a lot of Chuck E. Cheese's franchises in the Pittsburgh area. Chuck E. Cheese's, right? It's the party place for kids. Chuck E. Cheese. Right, it's got the games for the kids.
The food, even if you're not that I've eaten it, but from what I hear,
it's nothing to write home.
It's a bracha levatala.
Right, don't waste your time on it. Fine. The point is like this.
Can you sell in the same place?
So here's the question. So it wasn't a kosher. It was non-kosher, but here you have the pizza, and when they put the meat on top. So now the question is, does he have to sell it? You know? Does he have to sell the franchises?
Shiloh.
It's a Shiloh, right? Mm-hmm. So again, if there's a partner that's, you know, there's ways to structure it. What I'm trying to say is but how do you get the profits? So I'm saying you still have to get the profits in a way. You still have to structure it in a way where you can still get profits on the other stuff. Anyway, it's all been done before, yeah.
I had a congregant in Miami. He was on his way to becoming a Baal Tshuva. It wasn't complete Baal Tshuva, but okay. He was on his way.
Yeah.
And he inherited from his father a fleet of fishing vessels in the Keys.
What could go wrong?
And a restaurant. So a restaurant that also that served fabulous fish, the most amazing fish restaurant.
But I'm sure it wasn't only salmon and tilapia, right?
So what he did as when he became, he started becoming Furman, he kept personally kosher,
right.
He separated the shellfish,
right,
in a different case from the other fish.
Interesting.
And if he knew that you were Jewish,
ah,
and then like when I used to come in, he had separate everything for me.
Like the cooking, he had separate
everything.
Interesting. Yeah. That's great.
And he'd get insulted if I didn't come for lunch, like, because the shul was maybe 5 miles away, less than 5 miles away from his place.
Is this Rabbi Reamer? No.
This was when I was with Rabbi Reamer. Yeah, but this
regards from his nephew, who I saw last night. Yes, Jerry Reamer is in our class.
Yeah, he lives here in Atlanta.
Yeah?
Yes, he was at my house once.
Yeah. For the installation, he said that.
He came to my installation. Yeah. So David used to keep.
It wasn't a light fixture that they were installing. It's a different type of installation.
It was really interesting. He would not. If you were, he knew you were Jewish, and you came and ordered shrimp.
He was like, not happening.
He wouldn't sell it to you out of the case, and he wouldn't serve it to you in the restaurant.
Look at that.
Yeah.
Interesting.
I mean, it was
that's a thing. I don't know if it's good for business, but it's.
He did all right.
I've seen New York kosher restaurant open on Shabbat to me.
It's a thing that was never done, but now there is. Not everyone will eat there. But there is some hashgacha, there is some certification that will allow, again, with an interesting type of agreement that the Jewish owners don't own it on Shabbat. There's a partner that takes it over for Shabbat, and they take it back over Saturday night. So there are ways that in New York is so big, you can find rabbis all certified in Florida too.
It's called Ben's of all places.
Really. Like Mercedes or BN apostrophe S.
Yeah. They have an Orthodox Hashgacha, but it's not your normal.
Right. It's kind of, similar. So the AKC locally wouldn't do that. I'm saying the AKC is kind of like it's one organization, and they would not allow it. I know somebody that I know opened up a restaurant actually not too far from here. Restaurant down the block over here in Pond City Market.
The food is kosher?
It's not. It's Middle Eastern. But the question is there a way that it could be get the hechsher for 6 days a week and not have and but it could still be kosher for the, but it didn't locally it wasn't able to be done anyway. But again, you tell by the bill, $1,000 pastrami sandwich. You know it's kosher now. Okay, good. So that's how we know that, number one, the meat is not only a gedi, a kid, it's all meat, and it's not just cooking in the mother's milk, it's cooking, benefiting, or eating. Make sense? So far? Sort of? Okay. When it comes to kosher, so as we're going to explore tonight, we're going to try to find meaning, deeper meaning, from these details from the laws of meat and milk. Now, here's the disclaimer. Although the prohibition of eating, of mixing, we'll just use this general term of mixing meat and milk. Although it's in the category of a chok, a divine decree that is super rational. Nonetheless, when it comes to kashrut, the great commentaries of 1,000 years and even 1,000 years ago and even earlier, they've already shared with us that we can try to explore some rationales for even the super rational mitzvot, especially when it comes to kashrut. For example, this is a beautiful text. Ramban Nachmanides shares a really powerful insight about the laws of kashrut. Alex, please read this one, page 106.
I want to add explanation in the matter of the forbidden foods. The verse states, "Do not eat anything abhorrent." To tell us whatever is forbidden is rightly considered abhorrent to a pure soul. All of the forbidden foods are spiritually coarse and engender a coarseness and a spiritual block in the soul. That is why these foods are forbidden, whereas other foods are pure and fit for a pure person's consumption.
So the Ramban says like this, even though you might look at kosher versus non-kosher and say, what's the difference? It seems very arbitrary. And that in essence is really true, because that's what a chok is. A chok is a divine decree that on the surface doesn't make sense. It is arbitrary. But the Ramban says, but here's the truth. The truth is that which is kosher is good for the soul. It's spiritually, it's spiritual food. It's conducive to the spirit, for the human spirit. Whereas the foods that are forbidden, they engender, just quoting, they're spiritually coarse and engender a coarseness and spiritual block in the soul. So we've heard about blocked arteries, but he's talking about blocked spiritual arteries and pathways, if you will, that happens through forbidden foods. And that's, again, he said, this is obviously an intangible, or at least not something that may be measurable on a physical, an actual physical exam, right? Yet, spiritually, these foods make a very big difference. So, in the spirit of what Ramban says over here in text number 9, so we are similarly going to explain the spiritual meaning of the prohibition against mixing meat and milk. What does it really mean? What does it mean for us? And what are the spiritual and personal, psychological, emotional ramifications for it? So before we get into that, let's revisit a story that I think we know well. The story of Abraham, Sarah, and the three angels. So this takes place 3 days after Abraham's circumcision at the ripe young age of 99 years old. And he is circumcised, he's in pain, and he is outside his tent waiting for guests. Mike, text number 10.
Abraham lifted up his eyes and saw three men standing over him. And when he saw them, he ran to meet them from the tent door and bowed down to the earth. And he said, "My Lord, if I find favor in your eyes, please don't leave this place. I am your servant. Let me fetch a little water and wash your feet, and you can recline under the tree here. I will bring some bread and you can feast, and then you can be on your way." They replied, "Do as you have said."
If you don't mind, please read text 11 as well. So he invites them in, and then he feeds them as a good Jewish host. Text number 11.
And Abraham hurried into the tent to Sarah and said, "Hasten 3 measures of fine meal, knead it, and make cakes." Abraham ran to his herd of cattle and fetched a calf, tender and good, and gave it to the boy Ishmael, and he quickly prepared it. He took curds and milk and the calf that he prepared and set it before the angels. And he stood next to them under the tree, and they ate.
We had a class not too long ago about did the angels eat, did they not eat, etc. And one of the things I think that we discussed is, what did they eat? Look at it. Look at the verses. He took curds is dairy, and milk, and the calf that he prepared. So there you have it. So he is serving them meat and milk. What's up with that? We just got through this idea that the Torah prohibits not only cooking, but also benefiting. He's benefiting from feeding his guests. And not only benefiting, but eating. I don't know if he ate with them, but it seems to be that he's setting up these three visitors, angels, men, whatever they are, to violate a biblical prohibition. And so maybe you'll say, yeah, but this is before the Torah was given. This is way before. And yet we have a statement from the Talmud in text number 12 that Abraham kept the entire Torah. Lisa, please read this on page 109.
Rob said, "Our father Abraham kept the whole Torah, as it says, because Abraham listened to my voice." Rabbi Shimi Bar Chaya said to Rob, "Perhaps this verse refers not to the Torah, but to the 7 Noahide laws." Rob replied, "If that were so, why does the verse go on to say, 'my mitzvot and my Torah'? These terms are broad and inclusive. Surely his general term could not be used only to refer to those 8 commandments. Rather, Abraham indeed kept the entire Torah." Rava, and some say it was Rav Ashi, said, "Abraham even fulfilled the commandment of Erev Tav Shalim,
which is a rabbinic mitzvah."
How do I know? The verse says, "Torah," referring to the 2 parts of the Torah, the written Torah, scripture, and the oral Torah, including the rabbinic decrees.
Thank you. So what we have here is the Talmud expounding upon a verse where God is speaking to Isaac, Yitzchak, Abraham's son, and he says like this. He says, "I will bless you, I will multiply your descendants, all of the nations of the earth will give blessings by comparing themselves to your descendants." And all of this is because Abraham, in other words, your father, God is saying to Yitzchak, Isaac, because Abraham listened to my voice, he guarded my... Oh, it's too many parentheses here. Because Abraham listened to my voice, v'yishmer mishmarti, he guarded my ordinances, mitzvotai, my mitzvot, chukotai, my decrees, v'toratai, and my Torah. And so the Talmud says, what does this tell us? This tells us that Abraham did not just keep the seven Noahide laws, plus the unique one that he got, which was Milah, which was the Brit Milah, which was circumcision, which is why it's counted as eight. Seven Noahide, plus his unique mitzvah, which was a total of eight. But Abraham kept the whole shebang, the whole Torah, with the rabbinic decrees. And how did he keep everything before Torah was given? Maybe some of it seems very time-specific, and he was before that time. Then he fulfilled it in a spiritual way. But he kept the whole Torah. If that's the case, then certainly he kept a prohibition of not mixing meat and milk. So how did he serve his guests meat and milk?
He didn't know that they are Jewish.
Yeah, but then he's still benefiting from it. If you have guests, and you feed guests, and because of that, they are thankful to you, and that makes you feel good. You feel like a good host, and they give you kavod, they give you honor, and the whole deal, that's called hana, that's called benefit. You're benefiting, even if they don't give you a check, but if they give you thanks and praise, they say, or go to Yelp review. Yelp, Facebook, post, thumbs up, like. Right? If they give you some of that, kavod, then that's also benefit. So how could he do it? And so, of course, we get into a technicality when it comes to the mixing or the eating of meat and milk. And for this, we'll do a very quick intro. This is something that I feel like we have discussed before and something that perhaps some, if not all of you, might be familiar with. But when it comes to eating meat and milk, let's say you don't eat them together in the same literal food item. Let's say you down a piece of cheese and then you finish it. And now you want a burger. Now you want some meat. What's the law? How does that work? So Jewish law says like this. If the first item that you ate was meat, and now you want to eat milk, so it's separate, but it's chronologically, right? First meat, then milk, you have to wait some time in between the two. Why? So halacha says, because one of two reasons. Number one, the food, the meat, takes longer to digest. So it's remaining in your system, which means as you eat the milk subsequently, it's still mixing inside, which is now a new area of concern. It's mixing inside the system. A second reason that's given is because meat can get caught in between your teeth. So, right, if you're eating a steak, so you might have little steak pieces. This is before dental floss, right? So you may have meat stuck in between your teeth. Therefore, the concern is, you ate your steak, and you thought it's all good, and now you're eating a piece of cheese. What's going to happen? The steak in your mouth is mixing with the cheese. Before you know it, you might as well be cooking a kid in its mother's milk. Right? So it's no good. Whereas, if you eat the cheese first, both problems are averted. Number one, cheese is more, at least the I'm not an expert in digestion, but according to halacha, the cheese is more easily digested unless it's hard cheese.
Or you're lactose intolerant.
Yes, I was going to say, if you're lactose intolerant, it's got to be a whole new.
So again, I can't comment. I don't know, but this is what it says in halacha that
it's
the
like
cheese.
God created acidophilus pills.
That's the antidote, I guess. So halacha says the cheese is more easily digested and it typically doesn't get stuck between the teeth. Again, if it's hard cheese, it has a different category, but therefore you don't really have to wait a long amount of time in between the cheese and the meat. You can eat the meat pretty much right away, theoretically. So now, let's take a look at how this is described in Kitzer Shulchan Aruch, in the abridged version of the Code of Jewish Law. Text number 13, you just read, right?
I did.
All right, Sandrine, we're back to you, page 110.
One ate meat or food cooked with meat, he should not eat food cooked with milk until waiting 6 hours.
So again, if you first eat meat, wait a full 6 hours, that will, the digestion will happen, the stuff in the teeth will come out by then, hopefully, so then you can eat milk items, dairy items, 6 hours later. Continue.
If one ate cheese, it is permitted to eat meat immediately afterward, as long as one eats the meat in a separate meal. Instead of waiting, one must merely check their hands to make sure no cheese remain on them or wash them in water and picks one's teeth and rinse the mouth. If, however, the cheese was a moldy or hard cheese that fermented for 6 months, a person must wait 6 hours until eating meat.
I feel like that's more of the, isn't the French cheese like that type of cheese? Yeah. I'm not an expert in this stuff. There's blue cheese. Right, there's blue cheese.
Blue cheese
would be soft. Oh, is that soft? I don't know. Again, I'm not an expert in this stuff. What? Listen, it's all cheese. It's all Greek cheese to me. Anyway, the point is, this is the law. So now we understand what Abraham, what Avram did with the angels. What did he give them? If you look back at text number 11, what did he do? How did he feed them? First, he took curds and milk, which is the dairy items. And then the Torah says, and the calf that he had prepared. So the Torah is kind of condensing it, but what did the meal look like? First course, curds and milk.
Why do they say curds for chenah?
I don't know. Chenah is butter, no?
Butter.
Sure. What do I know? Curds and whey. That sounds like it should go together. Right? Right? Curds and whey, right? That comes from somewhere.
Thing, yeah.
It's right. Goes together like, I don't know, peanut butter and jelly. Anyway, curds, butter, whatever it is. He gave them the dairy course, the dairy meal. They ate up. They did the old rinse, wash, pick. Right? Your basic, you know, dairy safety check. And then he busted out the calf. It's not a problem. Now, if he reversed you, if the Torah said he first gave them the calf and the curds and the milk, then Houston or, ancient tent villages, we have a problem, right? Because now what's going on with that? First he gave them the meat, but he didn't. He first gave them the milk and then the meat, and therefore it's fine. By the way, you should know that many have the custom to wait a half an hour, in addition to the other stuff, to wait 30 minutes between milk and meat. Some wait a full hour, and it's based on Kabbalah. Kabbalah says that you shouldn't eat, even if you start with milk, you shouldn't eat milk and meat within the same sha'a, within the same hour. So many of the custom, Chabad included, based on this mystical teaching, to wait 1 hour between milk and meat, and again 6 hours between meat and milk. Make sense? Okay. Oh, and this explanation is text 14. Chazan, Ben, please read this one from the Bechar Shar, commentary on Bereshit.
Okay, he took butter and milk, and only after did he bring the calf, so that they shouldn't eat milk after meat. Thus, Abraham kept the commandments forbidding eating milk and meat together.
Now what we're going to do is explore, thank you, now we're going to explore the Kabbalah of this law. What is the mystical interpretation of this law? Why is it mystically? We know digestively, and we know steak between the teethly. We know all that, you know, all of those rationales for why one is harsher than the other. Why, in other words, why if you eat meat first, you have to wait a long amount of time before milk, whereas milk pretty much allows you to eat meat right away afterwards. So we understand on a very pragmatic, physical level why that's so, but let's learn this like they learned this in heaven. What does it mean spiritually? What's the spiritual meaning behind this law, between this interesting piece of the puzzle, that when it comes to the meat, no milk afterwards. When it comes to the milk, it's not a problem. You can have meat afterwards pretty much right away. Why is that so? What is the distinction? So, we need to first explain that everything that exists in physical form has a spiritual source to it. So, everything that exists, in other words, there is a spiritual counterpart to everything. So, a table has a spiritual counterpart. A book, water, a flower, even a blade of grass, everything has a spiritual counterpart. And the same is true with colors. Every color has a spiritual counterpart. White has a spiritual counterpart, has a spiritual source. The spiritual counterpart and source of white is the attribute of chesed, kindness. Kindness is likened to the color white. That's what it says. And what about red? What do you think red is? Red is the attribute, the mystical energy of gevura, sternness, discipline, severity. So white is chesed, and red is severity. Let's read a magnificent text.
When you say gevura, you don't mean gevura in the common
strength.
Strength,
no, it's related, but what I mean specifically is the Kabbalistic notion of gevura, which is withholding, discipline, sternness, judgment, you know, almost that which can lead to anger. It is not anger, but that's the attribute that leads to anger. Chesed is more kindness, giving, indiscriminate, which could lead to enabling, but those are two different, totally different paths. One is white, if you will, one is red.
Is that why older people have little patience? Because it says ben shmonim ligvura, because they're much stronger.
Right. Could be. It's interesting. Kabbalah does correlate the two ideas together. Gevura, which is strength, it's harder to withhold than to give. It's easier, for example, to open your hand. It's easier to open your hand than to clench it closed. Right? If chesed is giving is an open hand, and gevura, withholding, is kind of a closed hand, it actually requires more effort to close the hand than to open it. Open is a more relaxed state, whereas... Right. So there is a correlation between gevura, that strength. Even think about how one flexes their muscles. It's a tightening. It's a gevura posture, and a kind of there's like a sternness about it that is also the strength. Let's take a look at text 15. It's unbelievable.
Can
it's so beautiful.
One thing? I know I'm waxing too much, but interesting. Going back to text 11.
Yeah. Yes.
If you look at the trope in there, so there's the grouping is as far as the trope is exactly what it says here. So it says Vaytachem Avichalav. So that's one grouping, musical grouping. And then Uven HaBakar Asher Asah is another grouping. So because you have Kadma Vazlan Revi'i, and then you have Pashta Zakeh Katan.
Yes.
And so
I see
it separates the two.
Musically,
Vayikachem
Avichalav. That's one unit. Uven HaBakar Asher Asah. That's the second unit.
Exactly.
Yep. That's great. That's fantastic.
Okay, sorry.
No, don't be sorry. That's fabulous. Good stuff. Yes. All right, text 15. This is a magnificent text from the second Chabad Rebbe, known as the Mittler Rebbe, the middle Rebbe, although he's two of seven, but at some point, I guess, he was the middle. So here we go. He was prolific in his writing of Chassidut. He wrote a ton, and it's super deep, but it's really beautiful.
The sages say that there is no blade of grass in our world without a unique mazal as its source that causes it to grow. This principle extends to all plant life. Indeed, it even extends to inanimate objects. Mountains have their unique and individual spiritual sources. The more so animals and human beings. Even in the world is influenced by and derived by a mazal. Everything in the world is influenced and derived by a mazal. All in a chain of cause and effect that reaches up to the 10 sephirot of Malchut, of the world of Asiya, which are the beginning of the chain in the lowest of the world.
So you don't have to pay it. We're not going to get into all of the exact mystical realms that is the source of it. The important thing to know, as I mentioned, kind of introducing this text, is that everything that exists in the physical plane of existence has a spiritual source and its spiritual corollary as well, spiritual... mirror and source. Continue, please.
These 10 sephirot, or modes of godly expression, which are the source of everything in our reality, are all different from each other and exist at different levels, and each corresponds to a color. For example, white is the color of chesed, kindness, whereas red is the color of gevura, discipline, and the mixture of white and red is the color of the intervening trait, tiferet, beauty / compassion. And there are many different ways of mixing these traits, which are themselves comprised of each other and they're included. It is the various combinations of these modes of godly expression that give us the vast and multifaceted list of worldly creation.
So it's interesting, if you ever want to study color theory from a Kabbalistic place, there's a lot of sources on this, where you talk about what type of emotive energy a color represents. So, you know, before you paint your house, make sure to do some Kabbalah interior designing. I feel like that's a great company, right? Kabbalah interior design?
Jewish Feng Shui.
Yeah. So there's a lady that at the course, the Tuesday night course, she does this. She does Feng Shui.
All right.
So I want to speak to her and see, you know, throw some of these things, run some of these things by her and have a discussion. I think it would be a nice event to have the Kabbalah and the Feng Shui kind of come together. Huh? Anyway, all right. Continue, please.
For example, in our world, you have many plants that vary in color. Grass is green. Apples are a mixture of red and white. Wheat and barley are dominated by white. Honey and blood by red. Water and sugar by white. In inanimate objects, gold is dominated by red or green. Silver by white. Copper by a mixture of the two. Even people come in different colors, some being redder, some more black, some more yellow, etc. All of this diversity of color stems from the various combinations and influences of spiritual sources. The color below, therefore, reflects the spiritual source. Blood, gold, and honey all stem from discipline in their redness, whereas silver, water, grains, and sugar stem more from the spiritual, from the supernal kindness. So, too, the appearances of all creations reflect their spiritual source.
How cool is this? It's such a isn't that a great text?
Yeah.
It's fantastic. He talks about apples and honey and silver and wheat and barley. I mean, it's fantastic.
You're colorblind. You have a really hard time with Kabbalah.
I don't know if you have a hard time with Kabbalah necessarily, but yeah, it's the application maybe is. Anyway, so the point is like this. The point is that everything below has a source above. Every color below reflects a spiritual energy above. That's just the way it is. Everything comes from someplace. Text number 16, this actually comes from a teaching of our Rebbe's father, Rabbi Levi Yitzchak Schneerson, who was a Kabbalist. So this is what he writes in his comments on Zohar, which I think he wrote his commentary on Zohar when he was exiled by the Russians, by the communists, and he passed away in exile. The Rebbe's mother actually made ink for her husband. She went into exile with him. He was exiled, but she said, I'm not leaving him behind. So she didn't know where he was. She finally found out where he was. She went into exile with him. She used to go out to the fields and collect plants and crush them, whatever, make them into ink. And he wrote, and you see his copy of the Zohar, of the Kabbalah, you see his commentaries in different colors. The inks, depending on the day or the week, whatever it was, different color ink in the margins. And it wasn't like he bought the 12-pack from Amazon or from Staples that come with a different, oh, today I'm going to be, it's green today. Yeah, it's not, it's all natural. So text 16, Rav David, please read this one.
Milk and cheese stem from godly trait of kindness. Cheesed.
Good.
Whereas meat and bodies is discipline the woman.
So there we go. The white milk is chesed, kindness. The red meat is gevura. As we've explained, as I said, as we read, etc. Now, here this gets us into the big idea. One more piece of Jewish law, and this is going to be the grand finale. And that is as follows. I want to give you a very specific example. I'm going to give you two food items, and there's a few different combinations in which they can combine, or a few different ways in which they can combine. We have a slice of apple and a piece of chazer, a piece of pork, non-kosher meat. Okay? Apple and a piece of non-kosher meat. The apple is kosher, the non-kosher meat is non-kosher meat. So here's what happens. I have an apple sitting on the table, out of nowhere. Didn't see it coming. The piece of chazer, the piece of non-kosher meat falls on top of it. I shriek and I howl. I don't. And then I take it off. What's the status of the apple? Forever? Can I wash it off? Do I have to cut off a little bit? Do I have to throw the whole thing out? Can I just thank my lucky stars? I now have apple and I can taste a little bit of the other side. Like, what do I do? How does this work? It's solid. It's not liquid now, right? So it's, you can't say it's batel b'shishim, it's nullified, because that only works with liquid. It's not liquid. Huh? So what's, how does this work? So halakha, Jewish law deals with it. So it says, like, so that's my question. Do you need to peel it? Maybe you don't need to peel it. Or maybe you need to throw the whole thing out. So here's how it works. In Jewish law, taste only transfers if something's hot. So if something cold, if two cold items touch, one kosher, one not kosher, you just rinse it off, clean it off, and you're good to go. For the apple, I mean. Right? It's like, oh, I don't want that apple touching my...
For the pork, you got to do the broth.
Right. Okay. So very right. So you clean off the apple, and you're good to go. That's if it's cold. But what if they're both hot? If they're both hot, then the taste, heat, moves around the molecules, and the taste, the non-kosherness of the non-kosher meat transfers to the apple, and the whole thing is not kosher. You have to throw it out. But what if one of them is hot and the other one is cold? Do we say that the hot one heats up the other one and transfers, or does the cold one cool off the hot one and it prevents the transfer? Aha! You see the question? It's a very simple question. If one is hot and one is cold, what's the status? So again, I'm going to give you the scenario. Let's do this. This is our apple slice. I'm just using something physical here. Apple slice, non-kosher meat. This is the bottom, this is the top. Let's say this is cold apple slice, because why would it be hot? It's just a cold apple slice. Cold apple slice, hot piece of meat, falls on top of it. Jewish law says, when you have something hot and something cold, and only one is one and one is the other, right? One hot, one cold. Tata'a gavar. The bottom one influences the top one. Tata'a, the bottom, gavar, gavura, overwhelms the other. The cold apple on the bottom cools off, prevails over the hot piece of meat on top, and it's not considered as if the hot meat on top permeates the stuff on the bottom. Rather, the bottom cools off the top and therefore almost deflects its influence. Now, you still have to peel off, if you will, cut off a little bit of the top layer. But after that, you can eat the rest of the apple underneath it. If the roles were reversed, though, if the hot piece of meat, non-kosher meat, was on bottom, and my apple, right, there's a hot piece of non-kosher meat, and I'm cutting some apple. This is me cutting my apple, right? I don't even know. Right? I'm cutting an apple, peeling an apple, cutting an apple, and the apple flies out of my hand, lands on top of it. Tata gavar. The bottom one overwhelms the top, and the status of the bottom, forget the fact that it's kosher, is hot. So what happens to the mixture? The whole apple, it heats up the apple, we say the bottom, and now the whole apple is... The whole apple that fell on top of it, or the slice that fell on top of it, is now totally not kosher, and the whole thing has to be thrown out. You see the difference there? It all goes back to tata gavar. The bottom one influences the upper, the bottom influences the upper, and therefore, if it's hot, the whole thing is hot. If it's cold, it cools off the whole thing, and the law falls, the law flows based on that distinction. Make sense? Think about this within the human biology. Because we cited a distinction in Jewish law, whether you ate milk first or meat first. Remember this? If you ate milk first, you can eat meat right away pretty much. But if you ate meat first, you have to wait 6 hours. What's the meaning behind this? Why is this so? What's going on? So think about this in the stomach. You have milk. And what is milk? According to Kabbalah, milk is chesed, kindness. That's on the bottom. And then on top of it, you put the meat. What's the status of the meat? Gevura. So which one overwhelms the other one? Which one influences the other one? The chesed on the bottom influences the gevura. In other words, gevura is sternness, but chesed is loving kindness. So if the kindness is the predominant attribute, then it's a kosher mixture, if you will, because you're sweetening the gevura. You're sweetening the gevura. It's kind of like if you tell your child, "I love you, I care about you, you know, you mean everything to me." Let's correct this behavior so there is a little bit of gevura, but it follows the foundation of chesed. The whole thing is sweet. It's a kosher mixture. Person can accept it. Right? It's not fake praise before you go in for the kill. That's artificial. But it's real milk. It's real chesed. It's real dairy. It's not the fake, I can't believe it's not butter. It's the real butter. It's not curds, chazen. It's butter. It's, I can't believe it's really butter. It is really butter. If you have the chesed, the real chesed, that's your bottom layer. That's your foundation. Then the basar, then the meat, and the gevur that you put on top of it, it becomes sweetened, it becomes softened, it becomes also part of that kindness situation. But if the roles are reversed, if the foundation, if the first thing you put in, if the bottom is gevura, the first thing you eat is the meat. Gevura is the sternness. If you approach life, if you approach the conversation, the relationship from a place of sternness, and then you try to throw in a little bit of love, doesn't feel so kosher. The love doesn't feel so kosher. The love feels like, you know, maybe you're trying to back out of the harshness, or maybe you're trying to, you know, whatever, cover up or compensate for what you just said or what you just did. It doesn't feel right. Let's read this in the language of Kabbalah. It's such a beautiful, beautiful teaching. Text number 20. I think, Alex, I think we're up to you. Page 117.
The ha-ha is that if a drop of the non-kosher drink falls into the kosher drink, the bottom is dominant. And therefore, if the bottom is hot, it is forbidden to be consumed, since its heat transfers the taste of the non-kosher drink to itself. But if the bottom is cold, it is still allowed to be consumed. From this, we arrive at the law that first one must eat milk with its kindness and afterward meat, which is discipline. Since in one's stomach, the bottom food, the one that was eaten first, is dominant, and the discipline is thereby repaired and fixed by the kindness. This is indeed a wonderful repair. To eat cheese after meat, however, is forbidden, since the bottom is dominant, and therefore the meat, which is on the bottom,
So here we have a beautiful explanation. This comes from the Ramaz, Rabbi Moshe Zakuto. He was a Kabbalist. In his commentary on the Zohar, he says straight up this beautiful idea, and this is our final lesson for tonight. If you want to have meat and milk in the same place, you can do it. You can do it. You can't eat it simultaneously. I mean, you can't, according to Jewish law, you can't eat it simultaneously, but you can layer it inside your own system, providing you eat the milk first. Why? But if you eat the meat, in other words, you can ask the question, who cares? Who cares which one you eat first? They're still mixing. Come on, they're mixing in the stomach. Like, if you eat milk first, you could eat meat right away, but if you eat meat first, you have to wait 6 hours. Really? Come on, what's going on with that? I explained digestively and other things, but this adds another layer to it, and this is the spiritual meaning of it. When you eat milk first, it's chesed. Predicated on a foundation of chesed and tata gavar, whatever discipline you put on top of it, the kindness is mitakein, it creates a tikkun. The language that's used, that repair, it's tikkun. Like tikkun olam, like repairing the world. Behu tikkun nifla, it's a beautiful tikkun, it's a beautiful repair. If the conversation, the relationship, the atmosphere is predicated on loving kindness, then the discipline that follows is a beautiful thing, because that is also felt as an act of kindness. But if you first start off with meat, then the cheese is asur, the cheese is forbidden. As he says, the bottom is dominant, the meat discipline is on bottom, so it's dominant over kindness, and you never want to change kindness into discipline. Right? To change discipline, to make discipline kinder is fantastic. It's a tikkun. But to make kindness more severe, that's a distortion. You with me on this? And so in the final analysis, the final takeaway is as follows. We each have within us a little bit of meat, and we each have a little bit of milk. We have the attribute of chesed, we have the attribute of gevura. We should use the foundation with which we approach the world should always be, to the best of our ability, of course, with chesed, with kindness. We should approach milk first, dairy first. And then when we need discipline, rules, boundaries, laws, lay down the law, etc. It should all be coming from that place. then it's softer, it's healthier for us, it's more well received by the other, and it is sustained, and it's a beautiful tikkun because you're taking something that otherwise could be very severe and maybe head off into a really negative direction, and you're bringing it into a healthy place. Whereas the opposite is less ideal, and that is to start with severity and then throw in a little kindness. That doesn't have the same effect, and that mixture is not so kosher. You have to wait 6 hours to get rid of the severity, and then you can, I don't want to use a negative example, but it's like, it's someone who, you know, it's gvura, you know, gone very extreme, it's discipline gone very extreme, and then coming back and saying, oh, you know, I love you, whatever it is. It rings a little bit hollow immediately following something very severe, and it's not a kosher mixture. So let's approach the world chesed first, and in that way life is all that more beautiful. Thank you very much for joining me tonight for another session of Torah studies.